Welcoming back our cybersecurity expert, Dr. Vahid Bezadun, here on WICC. Vahid, what a time for you to be here, especially after the creator of ChatGPT was facing lawmakers on Capitol Hill earlier this week. So I'm excited to dive more into AI. How are you?
Doing very well. How are you?
I am good. My brain is on fire, though. The first thing that came out of that hearing that I think is so alarming to lawmakers, certainly, but even we, the listeners, is the fact that the creator of ChatGPT is begging lawmakers to have more oversight, to put rules and regulations in place. He wants there to be involvement with the federal government. What do you think about that?
Well, Melissa, 10 years ago in 2015, 2014, there were a few people in the research community who were talking about the risks of AI. And I was one of those few people. And then a paper, an academic paper came out, written by Sam Altman and other founders of OpenAI, enumerating the categories of risks that AI poses to humanity, to safety, and so on. And they essentially founded the formalism, the formal approach to the problem. Mm-hmm. Since then, AI safety has become a real area of research. There's quite a bit of effort being done at different universities, different companies. OpenAI was founded to pursue AI safety. And then suddenly, a few years ago, it changed its direction and became a for-profit company. It's no longer OpenAI. Sam Altman, who was testifying at the Senate yesterday, was one of the main authors of that seminal paper, and he was one of the early proponents of AI safety research. So it didn't come as a shock to me that he was warning about some of the risks involved or emerging from artificial intelligence. But the fact that he's seriously asking for regulation is a little worrying, because he's one of the few players who are earning quite a bit of funding from AI. And regulating AI would essentially close this opportunity to startups and those who don't have as much funding, because abiding by regulations will require more funding, paying a team of attorneys to figure out whether or not your tool is
that's interesting. So what you're saying, Vahid, if I'm understanding correctly, see, this is why you need cybersecurity experts, because like we, the public, I looked at that and I thought, wow, here's a smart guy saying I created a monster. Somebody get involved with the process. Even though that sounds a little odd, but if you listened to the lawmakers yesterday, they were like, oh, I don't think I've ever heard a company come in here and ask us to regulate them. From a public's perspective, you're thinking like, wow, here's a smart guy who's like, yup, I don't want to deal with the headaches that Facebook and Google and Twitter and everybody else has been dealing with. Let's just get regulation in place. But what you're saying is that he's actually blocking smaller players from entering this industry, essentially creating their own open AI.
Right. So after
tricky, I tell you.
Yeah. After ChatGPT came out, there were a few other people in the research community, in the natural language processing and machine learning research community, who worked on developing their own free and open versions of ChatGPT. Today, 4 months after the initial release of Llama, another chatbot, another AI that's almost as capable as ChatGPT, we now have more than 100 variants of the open source free versions of large language models like chatbots. So within the span of a few months, OpenAI's position in the market is seriously challenged. I don't know what goes on in the mind of Sam Altman. I have, he's my colleague and I have quite a bit of respect for him. But I suspect that this pursuit of regulation may have something to do with securing OpenAI's position in the market.
Interesting. So we're talking to Dr. Vahid Behzadan. He is our our cybersecurity expert, but he is also a professor over at UNH. I'm curious about this too, Vahid, is, you know, most of the lawmakers have said on Capitol Hill, they have no idea really what AI even is. Like, they understand the concept of it. But I always think about, like, okay, so how are you going to put regulations in place if you don't even really know what you're dealing with?
My guess is people like lawmakers like our very young Senator Blumenthal have access to staffers and advisors who can help them with this. But at some point in the future, it's going to become very hard for us to fully understand what goes on inside AI. I think the same is true for human beings, too. It's very hard for me to tell what goes on inside Homo sapiens, human beings as well. Yet lawmakers still manage to come up with regulations for how human society should conduct its business or social interactions.
So, wow, okay. I still feel like, and this isn't an age thing, like I look at myself as a millennial. I mean, I'm in my mid-30s. But if you were to ask me, like, what would you suggest to put things in place? I'd be like, just get rid of it, which is not the answer. I wouldn't even know. And of course, I'm not saying I'm some, you know, mega intelligent person. But I just think even though you hold a position as a politician, if you don't understand what you're using and how to even properly regulate it, like, I get why they want to do it, because we horribly failed in doing that with social media. But, you know, would you suggest in your professional opinion that at this point, if there's a call for regulation, you bring in a bunch of cybersecurity experts to do it, to offer what regulations should be in place?
Cybersecurity as well as, of course, AI experts.
Right, sure.
And Melissa, I told you 10 years ago, it was just a couple of hundred people like myself who worked on AI safety, and we were considered to be the fringe part of the AI research community. Today, AI safety is a big area of research. There are many, many experts who can provide input. And it's not just technical input, legal input, social sciences input, economic input. All of these are required to come up with an informed understanding of the state of the art and how things should be. So I don't think it's impossible to come up with regulations for at least the medium term, but it's going to need to strike a balance between curbing advances in technology and innovation, and at the same time making sure that, the Skynet doesn't rise up against us.
Oh, boy. Well, we are just in the beginning phases of what AI is really going to look like. Dr. Vahid Behzadan, who is our cybersecurity expert on the show. Vahid, I was curious. One of the things that Sam Altman had said in a previous interview he did with ABC News when they were doing a deep dive was he had said, you know, hey, we've seen these kinds of changes before. You know, let's talk about when they brought out the calculator and how did teachers manage that? And I thought to myself, well, they just told kids not to use them. I think in some ways you got a really brilliant guy, clearly, who knows what he's doing and created something, you know, extraordinary. But, you know, how logical is it that teachers now have to figure out ways that they can deal with ChatGPT, for example? How logical is it that people don't have to worry their jobs are going to be replaced by robots? How logical is it that other countries are not going to use this technology for the opposite of the greater good? You know what I'm getting at?
These are very important questions, and a couple of minutes is not enough to cover them, but I'm going to try. So, Melissa, no job is secure, but our jobs, the types of jobs that still require the human touch, are safe in the short run. AI is the is a solution to the problem of problem solving. If you have a generally capable AI, what we call artificial general intelligence, essentially anything that a human being can do, that AGI will also be able to do, and perhaps it may be able to do it better. One of the things that we are worried about when it comes to AI safety is the future of job and the future of humanity. What happens if human input is no longer required for labor to create economic value? There are ideas like universal basic income and ideas like, well, we'll get to enjoy our lives more because AI is doing everything for us. But we still have a few years to get there. You've probably heard that a few fast food chains have started using
Wendy's.
AI taking orders.
Yes, Wendy's is trying it, yeah.
McDonald's, KFC, Taco Bell, they are all experimenting with it. That's a particular job transitioning out of the job market. There is no longer a need for a human being to sit and take your order and confirm it with you. Is that going to happen with professionals like medical practitioners? Probably. I've already tried out a few healthcare AIs, and I've received input from relatives who are medical practitioners about those systems that are doing a slightly better job, at least in terms of empathy, in diagnosis, in prescribing treatment than human doctors. So there is a worry, and we do need a solution, or at least we need to start thinking about what life and society would be like when AI takes over more than 50% of labor.
Yeah, it's coming, like you said. It's inevitable, but it's being ready for that massive shift. And Vahid, I appreciate your time. I know we've run out, but I know that probably going to have you on more and more, especially as AI becomes pretty much the biggest focus, I would think, in the news and in our world. And it seems to be doing that. So thank you so much. We appreciate having you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Vahid Behzadun here on WICC, our cybersecurity expert on The Morning Show.
Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio. Now on Melissa in the Morning.
On WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
A couple big stories that we're following locally right here in sort of your neck of the woods. Let's start with Bridgeport. Pretty big story that Bridgeport apparently, or I should say Bridgeport City officials, are apparently calling on the FAA to allow the Connecticut Airport Authority to just kind of take over the Sikorsky Airport. What I think is interesting about this story is that, you know, I want to say maybe half a year ago, maybe even a few months ago, we sort of were at like this standstill. We hadn't really gotten like an update. We know that that Bridgeport had said, yes, we overwhelmingly not, you know, it wasn't unanimous, but overwhelmingly they wanted the CAA to take over. But then we didn't really hear any movement on it. And so I wasn't really sure if you could comment on where we're at with the situation and whether or not we really think the CAA is still going to take it over.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. So as you know, just to provide a little background on history, the CAA was definitely interested in purchasing and taking over operations, you know, beyond the operations, actually owning Sikorsky Memorial Airport. And Bridgeport City Council, who has the final say, accepted their initial bid. I think it was $10 million, which is pretty much at the ceiling, at the maximum the city could receive. I know there's a lot of discussion and debate about, you know, why only $10 million, it's worth more than that. But based on, you know, the FAA and other regulations, the city can only receive up to $10 million because of the amount of dollars they invested into it. So they can only recoup what they've invested. So that's a whole other conversation. But over the last year or so, you know, as they're digging in and trying to figure out, okay, how do we make this work? They've identified some environmental issues on the site. And that has basically, you know, hit the brakes, I guess, on a purchase deal with the city and CAA, the Connecticut Airport Authority. So they are pivoting now, and the city said, okay, well, instead of purchasing the property at this time, let's continue to do some work and figure out, okay, what exactly needs to be done there from a remediation perspective. But perhaps in the meantime, the CAA could do a lease deal with the city to operate the airport and just manage the operations, and which is what, you know, what obviously they do and do well. So now the question is, you know, can they work out a deal with the Connecticut Airport Authority that's, you know, equitable for both parties? I think the city needs their help, frankly. As we all discussed many times, you know, the city loses money on its airport every single year. You know, the city probably isn't in the best position to be operating, you know, with the resources that they have. So having an organization like the Connecticut Airport Authority come in and take over the day-to-day operations is still a great first step. And I would just add further, you know, we've had discussions, too, I think, on this call, and people have said, you know, the town of Stratford, you know, was and most likely probably still is interested
in buying it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But this actually works out better for the town of Stratford as well, because they'll still have a say. If it's just a lease deal, a lot of the original regulations and zoning and all this other stuff, Stratford will still have very, very much a say on what can happen there. You know, if it's a purchase deal, the town of Stratford is kind of left hanging. You know, if they're
they'd
not
be out of the mix,
the
sort of, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So this actually works out better in terms of through the eyes and through the lens of the town of Stratford, but it's also a win for the city. You know, if the FAA allows it. You know, I think, like I said, I think the city needs an operator to come in and kind of just straighten things out over there. Unfortunately, the director of operations, Michelle Boyo, resigned a few weeks ago. And, you know, so their hands are tied a little bit right now.
Right.
So we're hopeful that the CAA and the city can work out those details on a lease with, you know, perhaps an option to purchase down the road when they figure out all these environmental issues. And we hope that the FAA allows it to happen. You know, I think it needs to happen just to get us moving again forward to returning commercial service to that airport.
I'm surprised, Dan, that this wasn't an option on the table earlier on.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why they didn't discuss it. I think the city was just at the point where, you know, let's just get it to an appropriate.
Let's just like unload it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the Governor Lamont at the beginning of his first term said that he'd love to have an airport in South Central Connecticut. Obviously, Tweed has begun their work there, but it's been all privately done. You know, there's some complications on the Tweed airport.
There's
as well,
a lot of complications great. Going on. Oof.
Yeah.
I wouldn't
yeah,
want to so, touch that with a 10-foot pole. What's going on between them and East Haven and everything? That is a that's a nightmare.
Yeah. You know, and they still have some things to work out with the FAA, too. I mean, the FAA hasn't really signed off on a lot of the Tweed operations there. So there's a lot of things that need to happen at Tweed as well. So it's an opportunity for Sikorsky Memorial Airport to really be a resource. And we believe that on the business community side with the business council from day one that, you know, it's such a great asset. And, you know, look at Bridgeport. We've got all the intermodal options, you know, between the ferry, the rail, the highway, and the airport's right there. So, you know, it really is a perfect situation for businesses to leverage, you know, on the Gold Coast here in Fairfield County. So we're hopeful that the FAA and the two parties currently working this thing out, we're hopeful that, you know, at a minimum, we can get this lease deal done so that at least the airport could be operated correctly and managed correctly by an organization that this is what they do, you know. And they'll find out, I think, pretty quick, you know, over the 2-3 years, however long the lease deal is, I think they're going to figure out real quick whether or not they can make this thing work, you know, longer term, and whether, you know, purchasing it down the road is an option. But I think there's an interest there from the CAA. I don't think they're like, hey, you know, this is not a good deal for us. Let's walk away. I don't think they're at that point yet. I don't want to speak for them.
I don't think so either, Dan. I agree, because every time we've had the CAA on the show, they've made it very clear that they're already in talks with independent airlines so that they could bring one in, like we saw with Tweed bringing a Velo in. It's not a Velo, but they haven't disclosed to, but they are very much gung-ho about using the opportunity of commercializing Sikorsky again. Absolutely.
Yeah, agreed. And I've had the same conversations with Kevin Dillon, and And like I said, this is what they do, right? And they've done a great job with Bradley. You know, I think if you, I think anyone will tell you that, you know, the not just the flights, but just the day-to-day operations at Bradley are just so much better than they were, you know, a decade ago or two. I'm hopeful that Kevin Dillon and the Kentucky Airport Authority and the city will make things work and hopefully at least get them in here from a day-to-day operational perspective sooner versus later. I think it's a good thing if it happens.
The South End Community Center in Stratford apparently is getting $2.4 million in grant money from the state's Community Investment Fund 2030 for exterior and interior renovations, as well as program expansion, which is really, really exciting. I thought that was very exciting. What can you tell us?
Yeah, you know, there's so many of these, not just community centers, but, you know, local resources in these communities and neighborhoods throughout the region. And, you know, they do great work. They are a great resource for families, you know, whether it's the food pantries or the after school programs or, you know, daycare options, you name it. You know, the first one that pops into mind is all the work that Amanda Meeson's doing over at the Sterling Opera House. And similarly, the community center here in Stratford, you know, they could use a lift, and it's such a tremendous resource for the community and the families there. You know, these facilities need help. You know, they're nonprofits. It's not like they're generating tons of revenue. You know, they're just trying to keep the lights on, and to do these major capital improvement projects takes an effort. And, you know, they're serving a community that is underserved, really, right? So it's great that the Community Investment Fund is providing these opportunities throughout the state in communities like Stratford to help them, you know, to help them keep doing the good work that they do without having to invest tons of their own money, you know, to try to do these things. Because that, if they have to go down that road, it impacts the programs that they offer, right? And their ability to actually do the work that they're meant to do. So, you know, it's good on the state, good for Stratford, good for the community center in the South End. You know, I'm not that close with that particular community center, but knowing the work that they do and the needs that they fill, you know, are pretty significant. I forgot the number. I remember when the pandemic hit, there was a significant, because I was part of the Stratford Strong Group, and there was representatives from the community center and some other groups in Stratford. I forgot the number of people that were taking advantage of the food pantry, but it was like an exorbitant amount of food that was going through there. And it's like, wow, you know, it really hits home when you actually see and hear the numbers. And then the after school programs that they offer, you know, both parents are working in most cases, you know, and sometimes you're doing two jobs. So to have a safe place that you can drop your child or have your child stay extra for some after school activities, you know, that's important, you know. People don't think of those needs. You know, some families are fortunate that they have flexibility in their work schedule. They can bounce around and get their kids where they need to be. But having a local community center, you know, like that in Stratford as a resource is significant. And, you know, like I said, good for them, good for the state. I think those monies will go to good use to keep that building refreshed and, you know, structurally sound.
Sounds like it was a great thing to invest in, and good on the state to do that. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your extra time, and I always appreciate chatting with you. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about next week. Thank you so much.
You got it, Melissa. Talk to you soon.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Here's a question for you. Are humans changing the brains of dogs? Well, I certainly know that in our household, we are changing their voices. We've decided to give each of our dogs and even our cat their own voice. So whenever we ask them a question, we then answer in their voices. And I do know that. I know we're manipulating that. And but as far as their brains, this is an interesting one. David Mestre, I have no idea where this topic came from. And I just can't wait to hear more about it. Hello. How are you?
Oh, doing well. Yeah. No, this is pretty amazing. I mean, you know, I mean, when we look at all the dogs that are around us, you know, we are basically, you know, taking these animals and putting all these different kinds of, I guess, pressures on them that they would never have encountered in the wild. You know, just the idea that we're actually talking to them or feeding them or doing
sure.
all these other things. Yeah, you know, they're not the same kind of animal that they would have been
if
we didn't domesticate them. Now, when we domesticate them, that's still a bit of a mystery. You know, some say probably as far back as maybe 10,000 years ago.
I always wonder that. Like, how in the world did we even do that? How did we go, let me see, I'm going to pick you over there, you wild dog, and I'm going to make you into a domesticated pet? Like, how did we even do that?
That is still a bit of a mystery.
I mean, right?
For most part, we believe that all dogs really evolved from and were bred from a single species of wolf. So this wolf species is actually long extinct.
Right.
And what replaced it instead were the dogs that we see today. Now, what's really interesting, though, is that there are a number of different dog breeds that are out there. In fact, there are like almost 400 recognized dog breeds.
Oh, I believe that.
It's incredible.
It's insane. Yeah.
And so the variety, though, that actually is sort of a recent thing. But for the most part, many dogs for most of their breeding history were pretty much, they kind of look the same. So I'm looking at you, Siberian Husky. You know, I'm looking at you, the Malamute. Those dogs are very ancient breeds. We're probably thinking like many thousands of years old in terms of how old that dog breed is.
Isn't the Beagle, wasn't that owned by an Egyptian or something? Or maybe I'm making that up.
Yeah, that one comes a little bit later. You know,
that's like a basset hound and a dachshund together, right?
Yeah,
actually, yeah.
And some of these dogs, what's really interesting is you raise a good point. Some of these dogs were actually bred to do different types of work,
mm-hmm.
whether they were to chase down prey or dig out prey or go after small animals. So if we wanted a dog to go after small prey like mice or something like that, we made the dog smaller. You know, we looked for smaller and smaller and smaller dogs, bred for that trait, bred for traits like chasing and all that. And so we were kind of using these dogs sort of as work dogs. The same with the sled dogs. You know, you look at the Arctic has all of these different types of sled dogs, but these sled dogs have been around for a long time, and because they're ancient breeds, they have more wolf-like characteristics. But what's really interesting is when you look at those brains, and when you look at the brain of a dog and you compare it to the brain of a wolf, you find that the brain of a dog is anywhere from 20 to 25% smaller.
Really?
Than the wolf's brain. And you're like, why is that?
Yeah, why is that?
And so
we made them dumber? Did we do that?
We made them dumber.
Oh, that makes me so sad.
We made their brains do different things that they didn't need to do before.
You're like that teacher when I go, hey, did I fail this test because I just am dumb? And you're like, no, Melissa,
no,
you just didn't know the material. And it's like, no,
yeah,
it's because I'm dumb.
That's right.
I mean, that was the most educated way of saying, you know, why dogs have smaller brains than their ancestors is because, no, we just had them do different things. It's
different
like, okay,
things.
David, that's
nice.
They
didn't need to hunt anymore. They didn't need to mate the way they used to anymore. And those kinds of pressures actually put pressures on brain evolution. There were different types of evolutionary pressures on our brain that make our brain do all the things that it can do now. And we're still trying to unpack and unravel that mystery, too.
So did we kind of stunt their brain growth, essentially, because they weren't having to, like, so for example, hunting.
Yep.
They don't have to hunt because we literally give them their breakfast every morning. So we sort of stunted their growth in that regard, needing to learn those skills because they don't have to.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see
and
what
that's
you're
sort
saying.
Of the modern thinking. The idea that if you don't need certain traits, if you don't use it,
you're not going to have it grow. It's not going to grow.
You're going to lose it.
That makes sense.
So that's one of the things that's been happening with the brain. Now for a while, though, you know, these brains have been, you know, smaller. They didn't need to do a whole lot of different kinds of things that the wolves needed to do. But in the past probably 160, 200 years, the number of dog breeds explodes. And what's happening is that all around the world, you know, dog breeding becomes sort of a sport. And they're now, dogs are being bred for different characteristics than they were before. You know, maybe for sheepdogs, but now the sheepdog has to look pretty or has to have a different color hair or a number of different things that have no need. I mean, the dog doesn't need these things.
Right. This is just human interest.
Because the human wants it. You know,
right.
Maybe the human wants a lap dog. So we're not going to get a Malamute as a lap dog. So what we do is we breed these dogs so that they become smaller and smaller and smaller. I'm looking at you, Chihuahua. And eventually they become sort of a dog that serves a completely different purpose.
Mm.
But in the process, this is the thing that was really remarkable. In the process, we started seeing changes
what's getting incrementally? The brain?
The brains, yes. So we're seeing, if we're comparing like the brain per size of like small dogs and modern breeds of dogs like Shar Pei and the Shih Tzu and all that and other dogs that are considered the modern breeds.
Right.
We're seeing the modern breeds of dogs, their brains are slightly bigger and getting bigger. And they're different from like the Siberian Husky and the Malamute. The Malamute, if you look at that animal, that dog is pretty amazing. That dog doesn't really need you as much. It's incredibly independent because it still has sort of these wolf-like qualities that haven't been bred out of it over time because the Malamute was just bred that way over and over and over again for thousands of years because it was a really good sled dog. And so we made it that good sled dog. Mm-hmm. And it's just recently that, you know, now there are all these Malamutes around, but they're not pulling sleds, but they still have the characteristics of that breed. They are very independent. They need a lot of exercise. You really want them in cold places because they just have so much fur. You know, those are the things that those pressures on an animal over time can change the way the species works. And so why is the brains of modern dogs getting bigger?
So we're talking about if humans are changing the brains of dogs, and we sort of already determined that yes, but how exactly is that happening? Because now we're starting to see where domesticated dogs' brains are growing yet again, even though we sort of saw that they were stunted, you know, ever since their ancestors, which are wolves, their brains were much bigger than our domesticated animals are. But then, you know, in recent years, we've been starting to see that these smaller breeds of dogs, their brains are actually starting to grow again. What is going on, David Mestre? Why are the brains growing?
Yeah, these are very incremental changes. And so these take a very long time. But what really was surprising was how the brains really shrunk after domestication, like really rapidly. And so, you know, what may be creating sort of this increase in the brain cognitive abilities of the dogs is there's a theory. The theory is that the dogs now, very modern breeds of dogs, they're interacting with humans in ways that the ancient breed of dogs didn't really do. And what they're really looking at is they're looking at things like, how does a dog look at me and understand and is able to interpret my emotions, my verbal cues, or even signals that I make it. You know, so like hand gestures and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're thinking is happening, and this is still a theory, and we're still trying to kind of unpack this. The idea is that the way that these brains are growing is actually in response to the way that we are now interacting with these dogs in ways that we didn't do before when they were just work dogs. You know, we don't have the same kind of a relationship with a cow
right, because they're there for a purpose. And what you're saying is we're almost getting it with the emotional attachment. Even when you compare a work dog, for example, I have heard that when you have a dog that works the farm or you have a dog that even is like a canine, they change from their working years to their retirement years are very different because in their working years, canines are not really dogs that you play with. You know, they have to stay in a mode that they are cop dogs, because if they don't, that could lead to some vulnerabilities on the job. So like when they're at home, even if you have little kids, like they're friendly, but they are not really playful, roughhousing dogs until they retire.
Yeah, and I think that what happens with so many dogs that we've done all these selective breeding with, you know, we bred for different kinds of traits that made them best suited for the kinds of tasks that we wanted them to do, whether it was sheep herding or chasing small game or those kinds of things. But today's breeding, though, is really different. You know, we don't need a dog right now to do like sheep herding. I have no sheep, so why do I need a dog? And so what's happening is that dogs, especially all these modern dogs now, they're being bred for different kinds of traits, like appearance or temperament or any number of different things, and even intelligence. And so what's happening now is that we're starting to see very incremental increases in this brain size, and it may be because they need to be able to interact with us in ways that are much more complex than some of the other dogs. Like if I took a Malamute and I said, you know, go fetch, Malamute's going to look at me like, I have
why are you talking to me?
Right. Are you talking to me? Who are you?
Right.
Who's this dude? You know, but a retriever, you know, or a beagle or some other animal may see me and respond to me, and sometimes may even look at my emotions. Some modern dogs, they're actually able to do some of the same kinds of emotional interpretations that humans can do, which is really phenomenal. They have a way of tilting their head, looking at your face, and determining an emotional state based on the characteristics of your facial expression. That's really remarkable for a dog to be able to do. But that needs a different kind of processing power. And so they need to develop that processing power if they're going to be with humans for these kinds of periods of time in ways that don't relate to work. They basically relate to companionship.
Yeah, and it, you know what also is so amazing about this, David, is that there are dogs, I feel like now that, you're right, this kind of, you know, goes back to their breeding, but, you know, like I look at our dogs currently, and Trusty is a herding dog, and we never taught him, you know, like emotional intelligence. That was never something we taught him, like, hey, when I'm crying, you need to comfort me. Like, we just don't train that. And we have a golden retriever. Now, retrievers are supposed to be brilliant, right? Brilliant dogs. She might be one of the dumbest animals I've ever met in my life. And the two of them were trained the exact same way. We train our dogs all the same way. My husband also came from a rigid background of training dogs. Trusty is one of the most emotionally intelligent animals I've ever met in my life. And what I think is so interesting about that is, yes, their breeds definitely have to make a difference, because even in the household, if you're not training these dogs to react to, you know, if Chase falls down and starts crying, Trusty will run to Chase to go check on him. Willow will go chase a bug in the living room, like doesn't even notice that he's crying. And so it's amazing that they can even pick up on things that we are not even training them. Like, that's pretty astonishing, too.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the socialization process. Mm. I mean, we're socializing these dogs, and in the process of socializing them over a long period of time,
right?
You know, we're probably changing the way that they interact with us, and actually, in sort of a wild way, literally changing their biology and changing the traits that they have, because we're being selective. We're selecting for certain traits, and some of those traits involve how well they socialize with us. And so they're just responding to what would have been evolutionary pressures back in the day when they were in the wild. They're responding to societal pressures or socialization pressures or all sorts of other pressures that they would never encounter in the woods.
Yeah, that's so, so true.
These are evolutionary pressures from the living room, you know?
Right, exactly. I think this is such an interesting topic, and I'm so glad we did a deep dive on it. And thank you for finding this, David. I'm sure it really sparked an interest for so many. We have a lot of dog lovers out there that listen to the show, so thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
I think this is very cool. I'm going to think twice about everything with my dogs now. I just think that's their brain size. Like, who thinks of that? Science you may not know, right here on WICC.